is Kabbalah 99. I'm Deborah Sophia. Today we start our winter series with the theme of awakening in life, bringing practice and awareness into everyday life, right into the body of our being. We have on our call today Hafiz Neil Rothenberg. Welcome, Hafiz.
Thank you, Deborah. Good day to you.
Good day to you. Hafiz, you have been a murid and a teacher in the Anayatiya for over 40 years. Your primary teaching focus is on spiritual practice. A professor in organizational behavior at Ryerson University in Toronto, you incorporate meditation instruction into your course curriculum. So you've been a murid and a teacher in the Anayatiya. So just to clarify for our listeners, what is the Anayatiya?
So the Anayatiya is an organization that's devoted to bringing spirituality into life. It's a Sufi organization, and it operates within the realm of universal Sufism, in that one can be of any religion and belong to the Anayatiya. And there's a number of activities within the Anayatiya. One of the things that you mentioned in your introduction is that my focus is on spiritual practice, and that falls under the activity of the inner school, which trains people in spirituality. And there's a number of other activities as well, including a universal worship, a healing order, and a number of other activities as well.
And then there's Zerat, which is nature.
Yes. So another of the activities in the Anayatiya is an activity called Zerat. And Zerat is a vehicle of spiritual development using the symbology of nature and agriculture.
Well, maybe we'll explore that on a different podcast. So you also used the word to describe yourself, a murid. What is a murid?
Well, the inner school of the Anayatiya is an initiatic order. So in order to participate fully in the inner school, one requires to be initiated.
And it's initiation. Okay. So is it like being a disciple in a sense?
Sure. Yeah. In different traditions, you know, the person who is initiated would be called different things. Chela, disciple, an initiate.
One of the things Kabbalah 99 does is to explore the weekly parsha or Torah portion in a blog post and then have some practices to go with it to enhance the theme. And so we've learned by studying this weekly portion that the name describes its essence. So your name is Hafiz, and what is its meaning?
I believe there are a number of reasons that I was given the name Hafiz. So one of the reasons was that I was named after the Persian poet Hafiz, and I think that was the primary inclination around my name. But I think that the definition of the name Hafiz, I think also is keeping within my character. Hafiz means the protector, the all-watching, the ever-preserving.
And how does that come through in your character in daily life?
I think that, you know, in some ways I'm preserving the traditions of spiritual practice within the Anayatiya. I believe in many ways in my spiritual and personal lives, I'm involved in protecting people.
As an Anayatiya teacher, do you have murids?
I do.
And is that one way that you're protective and watching?
Yes, I engage with my murids on a daily basis.
You engage on a daily basis. Do you do this by talking with them on the phone or in an inner way? How do you engage daily?
In an inner way.
I see. Well,
we'll
leave that as a little bit of a mystery. In your professional life, you teach organizational behavior at the university level. How have you incorporated meditation instruction into your course curriculum?
So this is somewhat of a long story. You know, one of the things about if one has been, practicing meditation for, 30 years, 40 years, one can recognize that there's been a real transformation in how society views meditation. So, you know, within the university world, I would say even 15 years ago, you know, if you told people you engaged in or had a meditation practice, people would think that you were weird. It would diminish your professional standing. That has certainly changed in the last 10 or 15 years. And I would attribute a lot of that change to the mindfulness movement. Yeah. And they have been incredibly successful in bringing meditation into mainstream society. So this was something that I never really spoke about in my classes or engaged in with my students. And then about, there must be now at least 10 years ago, I read this really interesting article in the publication called Science, which is probably one of the most renowned scientific journals. And they did a series of experiments, and they were primarily examining distraction, and particularly distraction among younger people. So, you know, we're talking about people who are in their 20s. There were a number of experiments that they did, but the experiment that got the most publicity was this experiment where they put people in a room and asked people to sit in the room for 15 minutes. And there was nothing in the room other than a chair, a table, and on the table, there was a machine. And before they put people in the room, they gave people an opportunity to experience what the machine did. And what the machine did was that if you touched it, you got a mild shock, a mild electrical shock. And so before people went in the room, you know, they had them touch the machine and they said, oh, okay, this is, you know, I'm shocked. Okay, great. And then they put people in the room. And what they found was 66% of the men who were in the room and 33% of the women in the room shocked themselves at least one time. And many were shocking themselves multiple times. Because people weren't able to sit for 15 minutes, you know, just being by themselves and having no external stimuli. You know, when I read the article, had a big impact on me, and I realized, well, what a tragedy we're experiencing in society. You know, here we have people who cannot sit for 15 minutes without any distraction. So I decided, okay, you know, now I have to do something with my students because this is a tragedy. So I started to incorporate meditation as part of my course. And one of the things that I did prior to doing that is I did a research to see if there was correlation between what I was teaching in my course about organizational behavior and mindfulness. And I did find quite a number of studies that drew a correlation between, let's say, mindfulness and stress management, mindfulness and perception, mindfulness and motivation, mindfulness and conflict resolution. So I felt, okay, well, this is appropriate for me to be teaching meditation to my students. And in the first week, it was a program that we would spend 10 to 15 minutes at the start of class, engaging in various meditation exercises. But before I started that, I had people sit just for 6 minutes without any instructions at all. And then I got feedback from students about, you know, what their experience was. And most of the students were talking about what an unpleasant experience it was just to be sitting without any stimulation for 6 minutes. And at that point, I determined, okay, so what my goal is for this session is at the end of the semester, I'd like people to sit for 15 minutes and it'd be a pleasant experience. Great. So, you know, every week we gradually increased the amount of time that they were spending during meditation practice. And finally, the last week, I said, well, you know, we've done all sorts of different exercises. Now, this week, you're going to choose the exercises that you do. And, you know, we gradually had built up to 15 minutes. And I found that 80% of students agreed or strongly agreed that the experience of sitting for 15 minutes was a pleasant experience. And one of the interesting things was, I didn't assign any of the exercises homework, or I didn't encourage people to do the exercises outside of class. And in the evaluation of the program that I did at the end of the semester, I found that close to 40% of students were actually doing the practice, doing meditation practice outside of class. So that's the way it started. And since I have changed the program, I'm not doing the 15-minute program any longer, but I'm doing a modified mindfulness meditation program. I've incorporated it into 6 or 7 different courses that I teach at both the undergraduate and the graduate level.
And how does the faculty respond?
I haven't received much of a response to it. In the last 2 years, there was a faculty member who was hired, whose research is primarily mindfulness and organizational behavior. So wow. She was very excited to hear what I was doing in my classes, because she's a mindfulness practitioner and is also doing it with her in her research.
Well, that goes along with what you were saying, that there's been a definite shift over the past 10 or 15 years in mainstream America, corporate America, and universities to accept mindfulness and meditation as part of everyday life.
Yes, and in the last year, I actually founded an organization at the university called RU, and RU stands for Ryerson University, RU Mindful. Uh-huh. And there's a number of us from across the university, both faculty and staff, who either teach mindfulness or are researching mindfulness or are mindfulness practitioners.
So this is all happening in Canada. Is the U.S. on par, behind, ahead, or you have no idea?
There's a number of programs operating in the U.S. So, for instance, there's a program called KORU, K-O-R-U, that was started at Duke University. It's a program that teaches mindfulness and mindfulness meditation. I think they're in 400 or 500 different universities now.
Terrific.
And, you know, I was just, you know, during COVID, I just had my granddaughter, who's in junior kindergarten, staying over. And while she was staying over, she was attending her junior kindergarten class through the internet. You know, her teachers were teaching her meditation. So
that's refreshing, right down to kindergarten. That's really refreshing.
Yeah, so it is something that
is a new world. It's a new world.
It is something that is certainly spreading. It's actually kind of surprising to me, because I typically ask people how many have been exposed to meditation in the class. And when I first started doing that, it was almost no one. And still today, there's only less than 10%, probably 5% of the students that have ever been exposed to meditation, which is kind of surprising to me. I would have thought it would have been higher.
Well, there's more work to be done, and you're certainly on the cutting edge of what's happening in our consciousness. Your goal is to demystify spiritual practice. And that's an interesting choice of words, Hafiz. Isn't the Anayatiya essentially a mystical path?
Yes, well, it is. You know, I mean, if we look at mindfulness is, you know, gone to great lengths And, you know, for me, there's some questions about this, but they've gone to great lengths to secularize the practice of meditation. Basically, you know, mindfulness draws incredibly from Buddhism. It's my belief, and, you know, this may be erroneous, but it's my belief that, you know, what was being taught in mindfulness meditation in Buddhism wasn't being taught to lay people. In Buddhism, one goes on the spiritual path by becoming a monk or a nun. So these were, you know, practices that were basically engaged with people who were involved in an inner school rather than necessarily lay people.
It makes me think of yoga, because yoga is a deep spiritual practice, one of which is, you know, the physical postures. And it's come into this country and frequently is taught as a series of physical postures, as if it was exercise. But at least people get to do the yoga, and at least people get to do mindfulness meditation. Maybe it will open to something else, but it seems useful in society to have more people meditating, even if it's not mystical. So I really appreciate you saying you want to demystify spiritual practice.
Well, you know, I mean, one doesn't really even have to call it meditation, in that most of what I'm teaching in the public sphere, in my university sphere, is just really becoming familiar with your body and becoming familiar with your mind. You know, I don't even view this as incredibly esoteric. So, you know, so many people are not used to experiencing, for instance, something so simple as engaging the whole of their respiration system in breathing. Something as simple as being able to feel sensations in various parts of your body. Being able to be conscious of what you're thinking and how your mind operates. So these are things that are tools for everyday living. You know, there's not much for me that's particularly mystical about any of it.
But you said something kind of interesting, that you can be aware of what you're thinking. So what part of you can be aware of your thoughts? Aren't your thoughts you?
There's different modes of thinking. So the first mode of thinking is what in Buddhism they would call the monkey mind or the parrot mind. It's the recording in our heads that, you know, just uncensored flow of thoughts that we experience. That's one mode of thinking. Another mode of thinking would be that, no, we're going to decide what we think. Typically, when we're doing something like problem solving, you know, we're making a very conscious decision that we're going to direct our thought in a certain way. And there's another mode of thinking that focuses on the observing mind. So can you observe the monkey mind? Can you, you know, can you actually be conscious about, you know, categorizing or understanding this unconscious flow of thoughts that, you know, all of us engage in most of the time, actually?
So that goes back to your name, Hafiz, Watcher.
The Watcher, yes.
Yeah. So that's, you're bringing that quality of your name right into your teachings, both in the professional world, academic world, and with your murids. Let's turn now to your role as spiritual guide for other murids of Hazrat Inayat Khan. 40 years ago, what drew you to this Sufi master, Hazrat Inayat Khan, and the path of universal Sufism?
Well, I would say that it began when I was at a very young age. You know, unbeknownst to me at the time, I was doing a number of spiritual practices when I was 4 or 5 years old. But I didn't know what it was. I didn't know, you know, it was just something that I was just doing naturally. I remember that when I became a little bit older, maybe 6, 7, or 8, I had this book, The Arabian Nights. And I remember I was really intrigued with the architecture of the pictures that were in this book and the calligraphy, the Arabic calligraphy that was also in the book as well. And then, I'm a child of the 60s. So in the late 60s, there began to be exploration and spirituality. And, I explored things like yoga and meditation. And through that, I became aware of Sufism. I found this book called Toward the One that was written by the son of Hazrat Inayat Khan, Pir Vilayat Inayat Khan. And then I, sought out people who were teaching within that tradition.
What is the message of Hazrat Inayat Khan?
The message of Hazrat Inayat Khan is to experience the unity in the diversity of the world.
He also speaks of the cries of humanity in that our purpose as Sufi murids is to respond to these cries. What do you see as the greatest need of people today?
To find peace, to find inner peace. I go back to the discussion we had about these experiments that were done about distraction. I think particularly in Western societies, people are not particularly comfortable in their own beings. Many people are, agitated. So
yes, that's evident. You just have to listen to the news or sometimes just walk down the street and you can see that.
Yeah. So finding inner peace.
Finding inner peace. Okay. And can you give our listeners a practice that would help them find inner peace?
So there's a practice that I've been doing for about 40 years. It's a pretty elementary practice. And I have a sister who's a Tibetan Buddhist nun. My sister lives in India, in Dharamsala. Maybe 20 years ago, she was actually asked by the Dalai Lama to come to the United States to assist in a retreat that a Lama who had just recently left Tibet was engaging in. I happened to go to visit my sister. And while I was visiting her, she said, "Well, would you like to meet the Lama?" And I said, "Of course, I would love to meet the Lama." I said, "Well, okay, but you have to understand that, they don't like to just have meetings for the sake of small talk. So you have to have a question that you need to ask." And I said, "Okay." So, the Lama was doing a 3-month retreat. The room he was staying in is the room he was doing the retreat in. And maybe he was, halfway through the retreat. And you open the door, the whole room is just filled with light. And I sat down and, we exchanged pleasantries. And then he said, "Well, do you have a question?" And I said, "Yes, I do have a question. If there was one meditation practice that you would suggest to people, what would that practice be?" This is the practice. And it was interesting because I had been doing the practice for a number of years before I had met with the Lama. So it's a practice called counting the breath. And what one does is that one inhales, one thinks the number one. As one exhales, one thinks the number two. As one inhales, the next inhalation, the number three. The next exhalation, the number four. The next inhalation, the number five. The next exhalation, number six. So there's a pattern here. So you're inhaling on odd numbers, you're exhaling on even numbers, and you count from 1 to 50. And if you find yourself inhaling on 22, or you find yourself exhaling at 33, obviously you lost count because you're exhaling on an odd number and inhaling on an even number. And one starts again from 1. Until one can complete a full cycle of 1 to 50. And for some people, going from 1 to 50 is really challenging. So I would suggest starting from 1 to 10. And once one can do, a number of cycles of 1 to 10, then move to go to 1 to 20 and eventually build up to do 1 to 50 Again, inhaling on odd numbers, starting with the number one, exhaling on even numbers, starting with the number two, and actually using the mind to actually do the count from 1 to 50.
That's a fabulous mindful exercise. Inhale on one, exhale on two, and stay with that concentration until you get to 50. That's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. I hope people will give that a try. And what projects are you focusing on right now?
Well, I'm continuing to do work with the organization that I helped to establish at Ryerson University called Are You Mindful? So we're currently developing a website and looking at helping other departments and faculty incorporate mindfulness meditation into their curriculum. And continuing my work as a representative of the Anayatiya. Personally, I'm also starting to do some more research into the writings of Hazrat Inayat Khan. And I'm working in doing research on various aspects of spirituality, including things like cultivating the senses, work with the five elements that are part of a number of different spiritual traditions: earth, water, fire, air, ether. Yeah, so those are the projects that I'm working on at the moment.
Oh, that's very interesting. I wish you all the best in spreading the light of the Lama, the same light that you possess, Hafiz.
Well, thank you.
Do you have any closing thoughts to leave with our listeners to encourage them in their practice?
Well, of course, you know, it's incredibly important to engage in practice on a daily basis. And that's when really your life starts to become transformed, when one can engage in spiritual practice or meditation on a daily basis. I know for myself, and I know for others that I work with, that establishing a daily discipline can be a difficult process. For some of us, it can take years for us to develop the discipline to do meditation or other spiritual practice on a daily basis. So I have another suggestion, and this is what I tell people, what I suggest to people to do. So I would suggest that people have a document that has written down what their practice is. And if they're not able to engage in the meditation or engage in spiritual exercises, the least they should do is just look at the paper and read the paper.
A few minutes every day, just acknowledging that this is a good thing to do.
Moments, not even necessarily a few minutes. That only takes moments.
All right. Well, if they can make that a habit, I think when I want to establish a habit, I think, well, I brush my teeth every day, so I can do this every day. As my flute teacher used to say to me, you don't have to practice every day, only on the days you brush your teeth.
Well, you know, there's this really great story about a Sufi master and a disciple. The disciple was a person that engaged in drinking and gambling and womanizing, and went to the teacher and said to the teacher, well, I'm really interested in spiritual development and I would love to be your student, but I'm afraid that my lifestyle, you know, the way I lead my life is not going to be acceptable. Would you ever consider taking me on as a student? And the teacher said, yes, I would consider you as a student, but with one condition. You never drink or gamble or womanize when you're in my presence. Well, of course, that's easy. Okay, yes, I agree. You know, when I'm in your presence, I'll not engage in any of those activities. So the student went off. The teacher was a traveling teacher. So when the teacher came back to the city that this person lived in, he had a meeting with the person. The teacher said, "Well, how are things going?" And the person said, "Well, I'm no longer womanizing. I'm no longer gambling. I'm no longer drinking." And the teacher said, "Well, why?" And the student said, "Because wherever I am, wherever I go, I always feel that I'm in your presence."
He had to clean up his act. That was a sneaky way to do it. And did he have more peace? Did he have inner peace? That's the real question.
Yes, of course.
Okay. Well, gee, Hafiz, thank you so much for doing this podcast. It was a delight to have you on the call. And I hope to hear more from you in the future. Is it possible for people to reach out and get in touch with you? Or would you just recommend them finding something in their local area?
Sure, people can get in touch with me if they wish.
Through email? Is that how you
would? Sure, email. Yeah, if you post my email address, yeah, I'd be happy.
All right, I will post that in the blog post about you. Well, thank you, and we'll be in
touch.
Well,
Deborah, thank you. Yeah. Thank you for the work you do. And, thank you for, hosting me in this podcast. And I know this is one of a series, so I wish you the best of success with this program. And this is, a service that you provide that is quite valuable to people. So thank you for the work you do.
Well, thank you. This is a great kickoff to our winter season on Awakening in Life. Bye for now.
Bye.
For more mind-heart awakenings like these, you can follow us on this podcast and on our blog at Kabbalah 99. That's where we discuss the weekly Torah portion through the lens of today's challenges and offer practices to stay sane, grounded, and connected. If you like this episode, please remember to tell one friend about it. Next week, we'll hear from another thought leader who will help us to explore our experience of life and our place in this universe of wonder. Thanks for listening. I'm Deborah Sophia. See you next week.